everyone, from the crown jewel of the Front Range, Colorado Springs, although I'm sure people in Fort Collins would say that they live in the crown jewel of Colorado Springs, but because there are more guns in Colorado Springs, we win. This is Stephen Cohen here for episode 9 of the podcast, Quantitative Investigations. We are rejoined by our engineer, Goose the Engineer, who felt it was necessary to see his family during the holidays. What a loser, right?
Yo.
what's for lunch today?
A broken ankle.
Ah, yes. Yes, the other excuse for, not working. The broken ankle. How did we manage to do that there, Goose?
I was fighting a caged elephant at the Denver Zoo.
Who won?
Clearly the elephant.
I have a feeling if you were fighting an elephant and it damaged your ankle, it really would have just crushed your whole body.
Yeah, no, the zoo was actually my driveway and the elephant was just a patch of ice, so. Yep.
That is hilarious. Hilarious. In other words, you had nothing to eat today, though, right? Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, no, I have water. I have, what brand is this? Freedom's Choice Water. Wow, what are we doing? Yeah, we have, I think we have 35 cases of Freedom's Choice Water.
Ah, isn't that the same thing as, toilet water?
Yeah, it's close. I think we got it on base, actually, so.
That would be Fort Carson for those who are.
No, I think it was Schriever.
Hmm. What were you doing in Schriever?
Peterson.
What were you doing there?
A certain business associate of mine has access to the commons.
Okay.
Yeah. So this podcast might get flagged if we talk badly about Freedom's Choice purified water. So
I think if it's going to get flagged, that would happen at last episode talking about the FBI.
Fair enough.
Okay. Now that we managed to kill about 5 minutes, this is going to be an update episode, updating on climate change and some of the other topics we've discussed previously. What I figured out is more than 50% of the downloads of this podcast are episode 1, which was climate change. And the next, coming in second is energy policy. So it really is clear to me that there's very little interest in the more political subjects of this podcast, which actually require me to do the most work. So thank you. Thank you very much. So what we're going to start doing, I guess, is focus on more scientific issues, because that seems to be where the interest lies, unless somebody tells me otherwise. But because I don't really advertise the podcast, I really wouldn't know if anyone has any comments. However, this podcast is on Parler, and that's at Quant Investigations. So that's where we are in Parler. So getting to the subject matter at hand, I want to talk about ozone. Ozone has been in the news lately, because people are claiming that the ozone hole is closing up. For those who are unfamiliar, starting in the late 70s, there were some hypotheses suggesting that the atmospheric ozone, as opposed to ground level ozone, which is pollution, atmospheric ozone was being depleted by the use and emissions of chlorofluorocarbons. Most famously, or most commonly, I should say, they were used as refrigerants. Air conditioners, refrigerators, those types of devices. And the hypothesis was the emissions were reacting with ozone, and then the ozone was being depleted. And if the ozone gets depleted, then the atmosphere loses much of its ability to filter out ultraviolet light, which could be extraordinarily damaging to human beings, plants. It could be devastating. And that was the premise. And when I did some investigating into what the latest ozone data is, it really was kind of difficult to find. But I went on a website called Statista. I go on this website periodically. They have a lot of statistics, but they also charge, so I can't see everything that I wanted to see. There's an article on Statista.com called How Ozone Depleting Gases Almost Disappeared. And it shows a graph of various types of what they call ozone depleting substances. And you have chlorofluorocarbons, you have hydrochlorofluorocarbons, halons. Halon, by the way, that is a substance that's used in commercial fire extinguishers to put out certain types of fires. And what these graphs show that over time, as of 2021, there were very little emissions of chlorofluorocarbons. And the articles that I've been seeing in the papers or online are saying that scientists now expect the ozone hole to close up. They're lying. Like a lot of things. I am telling you right now, they are lying. And how do I know? Number one, I've spoken with enough scientists to know that the hole in the ozone layers, the holes in the ozone layer predominantly over the Antarctic, is due to a natural phenomenon. And that is called the Earth's magnetic field. I don't know if anyone can picture what a magnetic field looks like. Hey, Goose, do you know what a magnetic field looks like?
I don't think it has, like, flowers that you can frolic in. It's probably not one of those fields.
Oh, my goodness.
Can you believe that I have a bachelor's degree?
I'm not even sure you graduated high school.
Yeah, I'm not sure that I graduated middle school.
Oh, my.
It's got some poles in it. I know that. It's a north and a south pole.
It does.
Yeah.
So envision a bar magnet, all right? And then you have what the magnetic field would look like is you have a bar magnet, you have a north pole and a south pole. The magnetic field will run in lines, curved lines that start in the north pole and then would wrap around to the south pole. And you imagine that the entire magnet is surrounded by those lines. Naturally, those lines are going to concentrate at the poles. They need to. Because the number of lines, and what they would call those is equipotentials. The number of equipotentials doesn't change. But the area in which those equipotentials occur increases when you're in the middle part of the magnet and then decreases at the poles. Therefore, the equipotentials concentrate at the poles. Therefore, the magnetic field concentrates at the poles. The Earth is no different. The magnetic field of the Earth concentrates at the poles. And what does that result in? That is a common phenomenon at the poles, Goose.
I just couldn't even remotely tell you. I really haven't been listening.
That's okay. I'm not even listening either. I have no idea what I just said.
Yeah, but for me, it's just lack of focus. For you, it's just talent.
I just have no idea what I just said. It's called the Aurora Borealis and the Aurora Australis. The auroras above the Arctic Circle and below the Antarctic Circle are caused by the magnetic field being so strong at the poles, it ionizes particles coming from the sun. It ionizes, and that ionization causes fluorescence, and that is what causes the auroras. That same strengthened magnetic field, the same energy from that causes the auroras also causes depletion of the ozone layer at the poles. I know this because I know scientists who have been to Antarctica, and that's what they've said. They said, you know, all this chlorofluorocarbon stuff It's not true. It's that there's a magnetic field, and it's a very strong magnetic field at the poles, and it depletes the ozone layer. And therefore, we need to wear, we need to be very careful of our ultraviolet light exposure when we're working at the poles. So, you're going to be seeing articles from quote-unquote scientists or activists that are going to say, ooh, the ozone hole is going to close. I promise you, right now, mark my words, they will not close up. And I also promise you that the size of the holes fluctuates naturally. I'm telling you that right now. And however, if I am wrong, I will be the first to admit it. Because I always admit when I'm wrong, because that's part of growth. You know, no one's perfect. No human being is a deity. It's part of growth. If I'm wrong, I'll be the first one to admit it. I am predicting right now the ozone holes will not close up because it's a natural phenomenon due to the magnetic fields on the poles. It's something that does not get reported. It does not get reported, but yet it is a scientific fact. That actually goes to previous statements that you always need to be careful about what you hear on the news and on the internet. Because on the news or on the internet, what you're going to get information. But that information, to a large degree, is probably unsubstantiated. And I've had conversations with family members who said, oh, I don't listen to conservative news. I don't, you know, yada, yada. There's no such thing as conservative news or liberal news. There's news and propaganda. And a conservative news doesn't always get it right either. My wife, who happens to be in the studio today, she randomly checks the quote-unquote liberal news. And almost every time she does, she finds stark differences between what is reported on the quote-unquote conservative media and conservative news and what is reported on the liberal news. And that's probably one of the most disturbing things that we have right now on when it comes to the media. And that's why you always need to check source documents. You can't rely on what you hear in the news. Let's move on to the next false story. Anthropogenic climate change, which was the first episode of this podcast. So I just want to update where we are on global temperatures. And I use the website, as I've said before, climate4u.com. It's climate, numeral 4, Y-O-U.com. It's run by Dr. Humlum in the University of Oslo. He, from what I've seen recently, gets destroyed in the media as some kind of lunatic. What this gentleman does merely provides a clearinghouse for government and non-governmental organization data that gets collected. Period. He provides a clearinghouse. He does some statistics, which I have confirmed myself. For example, I have confirmed the statistical relationship between outgoing long-wave radiation and global temperatures, and actually confirmed that there is no statistical relationship. So he provides links for the data, and you can go download the data. And if you can't, sometimes the links are bad. Sometimes the links lead you to a place where the data is no longer publicly available for some reason. You can email him, and he will help you. Very kind gentleman. So, but he gets destroyed in the news media as some kind of lunatic. But remember, there are certain behaviors that people exhibit when they are intellectually backed into a corner. And in order of severity, it is insults, yelling, protesting, violence. And you always know you're winning an argument with someone. You always know you're winning an argument when they start insulting you or start insulting your data. You always know. And that's when you go for the jugular. But let's go to the satellite data from University of Alabama, Huntsville. The latest data that has been uploaded is December 22nd. We are still starting from 2016 to where we are now. We are on a downward trend of global temperatures. And that is satellite data, and that data actually originates from NOAA. Let's go to remote sensing systems. That is also satellite data, and it's satellite data generated from NOAA. Again, from 2016 to where we are now, temperatures have dropped. And actually, it looks like in both satellite data sets, the December temperatures have dropped significantly since November. Now, these are, by the way, these are monthly temperature averages that I'm giving you. Here's where you need to be careful, because a lot of times global temperatures will be presented as yearly averages, and the yearly average does not say the same thing or may not say the same thing as a monthly average. Yearly averages, and I think the last time I did this, which was 2021, it still showed that temperatures were increasing. I believe the last time, that's what happened the last time I did it. Meanwhile, the monthly averages, it's more important to look at the monthly averages because you can see the trends more clearly. Monthly averages have been dropping between December of 22 and it looks like, say, beginning of 2016, maybe, temperatures have dropped significantly. Now, when you look at these temperatures, what you're going to see is a temperature anomaly. And what is a temperature anomaly? A temperature anomaly is a monthly average compared to a broader average. What does that mean? So what these scientists do, and I guess this averaging is a way they can process large and geographically disparate data, what they'll do is they'll determine a zero number. And that zero number might be, say, from 1985 to 2000, right? Maybe something like that. And that's the zero. And then each individual month is assigned a plus or minus depending on where it falls relative to that average. And the remote sensing systems, for example, let's go over University of Alabama, Huntsville. The reference period is 1991 to 2020. So the average of all temperatures from the 1991 to 2020 is used as your zero. And then everything else is compared to that. So let's take a look at the anomalies. For the University of Alabama, Huntsville data, the anomaly goes from 2016 is 0.7 to where we are right now in December is 0.05. That's where we are. When you look at remote sensing systems, I don't see what the reference period is. Looking, I cannot find the reference period. And different data sets will tend to use different reference periods. But for the remote sensing systems, in 2016, it looks like it goes from 1.25 in 2016 to 0.45 where we are right now. And that's how the temperature data works. In actuality, I think it might be an easier way to deal with large data sets over large geographic areas. Continuing, we have the Climate Research Unit in England that still shows a downward trend from 2016 to 2022. And December looks like it dropped significantly from November. Let's go to NOAA. Still the same thing. And NASA. Same thing. Now, NASA, which is the GISS temperature data set, those are surface air temperatures. NOAA is, I believe NOAA is surface air there's surface air temperatures. And the Climate Research Unit is also surface air temperatures, where again, remote sensing systems in University of Alabama, Huntsville, are satellite. All the data sets are saying the same thing. The degree of difference may vary, but they are all saying the same thing. And I'm going to remind everyone, there's not a single person on the face of this planet other than me who publicly stated that temperatures are going to start decreasing from 2016 or 2015. I made the prediction that temperatures and carbon dioxide were going to start diverging. And they have been. They have been. No one else has made that prediction. I can't find that prediction anywhere on the internet. And again, I remind everyone, about 30 people were there to hear it, 27 of whom were not related. So let's take a look at sea ice, because everyone seems to focus on sea ice, which is something that the International Panel on Climate Change has never been able to predict. Where are we? So the latest images from the National Snow and Ice Data Center are January 1st, 2023. And what it looks like is for the Arctic, the extent of the ice is at the bottom of the average. And I think actually it's minus two standard deviations. So what these graphs show you from the Snow and Ice Data Center is they'll show you an average from 1981 to 2010. And they'll show you a band of two standard deviations. And then they'll show you 2012 to 2013. And then now they also show 2022 to 2023. And the Arctic ice is at the same level it was in 2012 to 2013. But it doesn't always stay there. Sometimes it's higher than that time frame. Sometimes it's lower. Right now, it's definitely below average. The Antarctic has been pretty interesting because at some points, it's been above average. Right now, it is below the 2021-2022 numbers. So right now, it is low. But at no time since I've been tracking this and since they've been collecting data has the ice disappeared during the summer at either the Antarctic or the Arctic. So that's where we are. Let's take a look. Let's take a look at greenhouse gases. Let us take a look, shall we? I think we should. Hey, Goose, what do you think carbon dioxide has been doing?
I think carbon dioxide has been doing some stuff.
I just want to let everyone know that, you know, again, Goose is not an official part of the show. I just use him to break up the monotony in my voice.
And but, monotony, I break up. I sure do. Ooh-wee. This is me breaking up the monotony. And Steve is drinking water, and he's drinking water, so I'm talking to let him drink water.
Okay, you're good.
Okay, all right, thanks.
I actually think he's smarter than he really is, but he has no vested interest in showing how smart he is.
Well, yeah, I can't give away my big secret.
There you go.
Intelligence is no good if everyone knows you're intelligent.
Yeah, what were you, valedictorian of your kindergarten class? Is that true?
It was actually pre-K. I was just really good at spelling my name.
Yeah, Goose is very hard to spell.
Yeah, you know, one O, two S's, right?
Right. All right, carbon dioxide right now, it looks like it's around 420 parts per million, which, if you remember from the episode one, that is still at about the same, if not even a little bit lower than where it was in the early 1940s and in the mid-1820s. So We're still not breaking any land speed records. Mind you, no one ever feels like reporting what has been done by Ernst Georg Beck, even though that work has been published, because they don't care. Because it doesn't support the narrative. So that's where we are. That's where we are with climate change. And actually, I'm going to go back to the Climate for You website for a second. The one thing when you want to look at, if you want to know, there are two ways to predict what temperatures are going to do. One is solar radiation. And unfortunately, like I said, the Laboratory for Atmospheric and Space Physics no longer publishes the data. And they had really good satellite total solar irradiance data. They had a 17-year mission, and lo and behold, the mission ended. And lo and behold, the mission ended just at the point where the Earth lost 1 watt per square meter of total solar irradiation from the sun. And they decided, well, we don't need to collect data anymore because our mission's up. Okay, fine. The satellite's still up there. Somebody's collecting the data. They're just not publishing it. But that's the way things work sometimes. The other piece to look at is sunspots. And why is that? That's a good question. And I'm trying to find the sunspot data, and now I can't find it. There it is, I think. The sunspot data is important because the amount of solar radiation that hits the Earth has a strong relationship to sunspots, to the sunspot number. And the number of sunspots in any given time has an 11-year cycle, and you can almost set your watch to this cycle. And that sunspot cycle is what controls the El Niños and the La Niñas. Okay? When you're just past the peak of sunspot number, in sunspot number is when you start your El Niños. When you're just past the ebb of the sunspot number, the low point, is when you start your La Niñas. Right now, and I'm looking at the sunspot numbers, and this is again on climateview.com website. The sunspot number and the peak, these are the peaks, have been slowly decreasing since 1989. And in 2014 is when you had a really big drop in sunspot number. Now, and we are right now just at the peak of the next 11-year cycle. So, in a few years, we're going to hit an El Niño. Again, mark my word. Maybe it'll be 2 years. Well, we'll be in an El Niño. But they're not going to be strong. They're not going to be strong because the sunspot number at the peak in December, right now in December of 2022, is 100. In 1989, the highest value, which might look a little anomalous, is 275. So we have been losing solar radiation since 1989. Now, of course, you're gonna go ahead and look at the global temperature graphs, and you'll see that temperatures were still increasing at that point. Yeah, they were, and that's because we yet do not understand how much heat the Earth traps. And by the Earth, I mean atmosphere, land, and water. We don't yet know how much heat it stores. We don't yet know on how long it takes to release heat. We have vast oceans. Those vast oceans are heat sinks. So when we get a change in solar radiation, it's going to take time for that heat to dissipate, for perhaps or to feel it in global temperatures. But we don't know. And why don't we know? Because science has decided that solar irradiation doesn't control our climate, that carbon dioxide does. And since you know all the answers before you do the research, then there's no reason to look at anything else. That's called garbage in, garbage out. That's why we don't know anything. It's the same reason why we've had problems with the COVID vaccine, which, by the way, that is going to be one. The whole COVID issue is going to be one of my episodes, and I'm hoping to get a special guest for that. But when you know the answer ahead of time, you don't look at anything else. And remember, in order to believe in anthropogenic climate change, you need to believe that the sun only provides 10% of the input into our climate, and that 99.95% of the mass of the atmosphere does not trap any heat. Both of those premises are garbage. They are complete and utter garbage. The second one violates the basic heat transfer equation. Just violates it completely. And these are obviously well-known documented scientific laws and principles. So where we are right now is our peak for this solar cycle appears, and we're not finished with the peak yet. We still have probably 2 years to go. But the peak is below where we were at around 2013, 2014. The Earth is going to start cooling, and it's going to keep cooling. I'm not going to say it's going to completely cool. I'm not going to say we're heading into an ice age. But global temperatures will not be increasing as long as these sunspot numbers stay low. So, now that we have finished that, let's move on to another interesting topic. So, at this point in time, we've been hearing a lot about the national debt. Hey, Goose, do you know what the national debt is right now?
It's definitely higher than my personal credit card debt.
Not by much, though, I don't think.
I don't think by much either. Yeah, but to be fair, if my credit card debt was that high, I don't think my credit score would be even in the positive numbers. They'd probably have to invent negative number credit scores for me.
Yeah, so
it's something trillion, like what, like 30 trillion, 20 something trillion?
That's not bad. 31.4 trillion. All right, thank you very much.
You know, to be fair, I knew it was like 20-ish trillion maybe like 5 years ago, so I just kind of guessed.
Extrapolated.
I did a project in fifth grade on hyperinflation, so not that that really has anything. I mean, it kind of has something to do with our debt, but like...
It does. Absolutely, you know, does.
You know, I've taken that ever since then. I think back then it was like 13 trillion back in my day.
That would be amazing.
Yeah.
So right now we're sitting around $31.4 trillion worth of debt, and Congress has not authorized a debt increase. So you're hearing a lot of hyperbolic discussions from politicians, political appointees, the news media, that if we don't increase the debt, if we do not increase the debt, we will default on our loans. We will default on our loan payments. I'm going to tell you right now, that is patently false. And the people who are saying that know it's patently false. They're lying. And I've been using that word a lot. But that's because there's a lot of misinformation and disinformation out there. And anyone who's listened to the previous episodes of my podcast knows what the deal is. But let's go to the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment, part of it, it's a multi-part amendment, but one of the parts of the 14th Amendment of the Constitution is that the debt of the United States shall never be in doubt. Okay, so right now we are at our debt limit and we can't borrow any more money. What does that mean? Well, we still have the country is still bringing in approximately $4.5 trillion in revenue. So what is that per month? That is $375 billion a month that we are bringing in. So we have about $440 billion at this point. This is the last number I heard. I haven't checked the latest budget summary tables. But we, our debt payment annually is $440 billion. Well, $375 billion a month worth of revenue, what would necessarily happen is that our first priority would be paying off the debt. Okay? That's what would happen. Let's go to the calculator. So you have 4.5 trillion by 440 billion. These numbers are so big. It's crazy. That's not what I wanted to do. Let's try that again. You know what? Never mind. Which that'll still leave us $4 trillion. That'll still leave us about $4 trillion of revenue in which to fund the government. But that's all going to have to be prioritized. Right? If our debt limit is stopped and we can't borrow any more money, and whatever money's coming in is what's coming in, and that's it. And we can then prioritize what it is we need to spend money on. Will Congress do that? I don't know. Will Congress raise the debt, national debt ceiling? I don't know. But for those of you who've listened to the federal budget and inflation episode, you know what all this means. Our national debt is $31.4 trillion. And you can go do your own research to see how large that is, but that's pretty large. That's larger than the GDP of many countries. So with that kind of debt, and if interest rates keep increasing, it's easy to see how the debt payment could balloon, and then there will be no choice. The federal government's going to have to cut programs and cut programs severely. This whole thing is a self-inflicted wound. It's perpetrated by irresponsible politicians, but it's also perpetrated by an irresponsible public. The voters elect the people who are putting our country at risk due to large debt. We elect them. If we as a people aren't going to be smart enough to elect people who are going to cut the debt, then we get what we deserve. At this point in time, we elect the people who control the budget. All I can tell you is stop electing people who are not going to control the debt. It's very simple. So I just want to let you know, you're going to hear a lot about the national debt and how if we don't raise the debt ceiling, we're going to default on our loans. That's false. It's absolutely false. Let's go to something I haven't spoken about before, incrementalism. So communists and leftists, and I'm just talking globally, not necessarily in the United States, play a long ball game. When there's an entrenched institution that a communist wants to change or destroy, they know instinctively they're not going to be able to do it at once. Now, the perfect example of this is the Second Amendment. Over time, the communists and leftists in our government have been trying to eliminate the Second Amendment. First, it was automatic weapons ban. Okay, I think most people can agree that was probably a good thing to do. They also had the quote-unquote assault weapons ban. And whether or not that actually affected anything, In my episode on gun violence, guns and gun violence, I've given you the information where you can look at that for yourself. But what's happening now, and since they bring me the past 10 years, is that municipalities have been trying to ban concealed carry and ban semi-automatic weapons. Now, there is an active ban in Illinois. Governor Pritzker signed it last week. A ban on semi-automatic rifles and handguns. So your Glock 19s, for example, along with the AR-15s, would be banned. Right? These are incremental steps out of destroying the Second Amendment. Now, I just read this morning that a judge just overturned, or I should say, put a stay on that ban. So right now, that ban is not in effect. But this is how incrementalists work. It's the same thing with the trans movement, the transgender movement. And mind you, I am not saying one way or another. I'm not offering my opinion one way or another. I'm just telling you how it works. You start moving gay rights, gay marriage, then all of a sudden it goes to transgender people can use whatever restroom they want. And none of that would have happened all at once. And the opposite of incrementalism is absolutism. None of that would have happened all at once. Right? It has to be done incrementally. Again, I'm not offering my opinion one way or another on that. I'm just telling you how it works. Absolutism will never defeat incrementalism, except under certain circumstances, very rare circumstances. The 2016 election of Donald Trump was an instance that an absolutism movement beat incrementalism. Over the long term, it will not. So there is an incremental movement to destroy the Second Amendment. But the focus that everyone needs to be aware of is incrementalism and how it works. And if you look at Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals, you look at these seven pillars of a color revolution, you even look at Marx, those provide the basis for incrementalism. Last thing I want to talk about is energy. Okay, if you listen to my episode on energy, energy policy, what we discussed were the various metrics behind which are the more reliable forms of electrical generation and which are not. And the metrics are clear that wind and solar are not reliable forms of electrical generation. I downloaded some data from ERCOT. ERCOT is the Energy Reliability Council of Texas. So that's basically the utility umbrella that is running parts of Texas, the energy generation. December 23rd, there was actually a federal order that granted ERCOT the ability to increase output to meet electrical demand. Take a guess. Take a guess on where that output originated. That extra output. It was from gas. Why is that? Because you can't increase output from wind and solar. You can't do it. Right now, anyway. Whether you can with storage technology, I don't know. So, it's a lesson. It is a lesson. When you look at the numbers, you certainly begin to understand. You can certainly dissect your world around you. So, anyway. Hey, Goose. What's going on, Hopalong?
Just trying to learn how to walk again, which, you know, would seem pretty rudimentary considering I did it for 22 years. But it's proving to be harder than I thought, this whole walking thing.
So how long have I been talking today?
44 minutes and
all right.
44 seconds.
Wow, I stretched that out pretty good.
Yeah, you did.
I didn't think I had that much to talk about today.
Well, there's one thing I've learned. It's that Steve always has it in him.
Yeah, I am. I have the gift of the gab. So I think we can wrap this up. Thank you very much for listening to episode 9 of Quantitative Investigations, and I bid you a fond adieu.